Getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you. And also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at tmobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to four lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device credit service ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan, and joining us today is another good friend. Adrienne Majors, the Director of Marketing and Communications at My Possibilities, and she's going to talk about some more of the amazing work they do with adults who have intellectual and or developmental disabilities. Adrienne, good talking to you again. How you been?
Good morning. How are you? I've been well.
And more importantly, how are the hipsters?
They are great. We just started a new semester, which is always a fun time. It's an opportunity for them to get to experience some new classes, and they are just so eager to step in and do all the things. So,
for those who don't know, hipsters are hugely important people, and they are those who go to My Possibilities because, again, it's all about improving themselves and making a change in the community and around the country and letting people who know that those with cognitive disabilities have an opportunity to get a diploma and get a really good job. Did I say that right?
Mostly right. So one thing to note is that it's lifelong education, so they don't graduate out of our programs. However, with the new building that we opened up last October, it's been almost a full year, the Employment Innovation School, there are opportunities for those interested in five specific tracks to receive specific certifications to help them obtain jobs. So a little bit different than like a university where you're getting a true diploma.
I love this. And let's talk again about the new campus in particular, because I believe it's the only campus of its kind in the state of Texas.
That is correct. We have about 70,000 square feet that's already built out on about 20 acres here in Central Plano. We are very visibly located right off of George Bush between Coit and Independence, and have future plans to develop out the rest of the land that we have out here. So currently we have two buildings. One is our Fisher Family School of Life Skills, which, as I mentioned, is more of our lifelong learning. It's independent living skills, it's social skills, all of that. And then our second building is the Employment Innovation School, powered by Bread Financial, where we are working to create pathways for our individuals to go out into the community and gain meaningful employment.
Let's talk about the last one right now, because I think that's very insightful and very helpful for people who might have hipsters in their lives or in their families.
Absolutely. So the newer school, like as I mentioned, opened October of last year. We offer three levels of programming over there. So one is going to be pre-vocational skills, and that's really those hipsters who are just now talking and thinking about what having a job might look like. We have general vocation, which is more of the soft skills around having jobs, working on how to interview, how to write a resume, things of that nature. And then we have what's considered our track-specific programming that's all focused around five different industries. It's retail, culinary arts, administration, hospitality, and facilities. And those individuals who go through the assessment and we determine are ready to hit the tracks will learn both those soft and hard skills within each of those industries. And we have some in our culinary arts program who have already received their food handlers certifications. We have have a group that just finished their OSHA 10 certification last week from our facilities track, and then another group that just got their TABC licensing. So those will be for culinary and our hospitality tracks.
That is fantastic. Again, just great news coming out of My Possibilities. Adrienne, the last time I talked to you a couple of years ago, we were talking about all the different things, not just My Possibilities, but different nonprofits and different corporate world individuals had to make a pivot coming out of the pandemic and the trials of the pandemic. I've also noticed, you know, in the last couple of years that a lot of employers are more open to having different kinds of employees. In other words, not just different kinds of people, but the way they would work. Some could stay at home. Some could come into work every other day, every now and day, or you know, once or twice a week. Have you found that has it been easier to place and have more opportunities for the hipsters in this new environment?
Honestly, I think we do have some individuals that were very fortunate who were able to maintain their jobs during the pandemic and were, you know, offered the opportunity to work remotely. So that definitely was something new and different. I would say in general, you know, a lot of our folks are going to do better probably in person. But what we're seeing more of is just the education and awareness around what it's like to hire inclusively. And it's our goal to go out into the community and our responsibility to go help businesses understand what that means. And that while a lot of people may have these unconscious biases about what it's like to have to offer accommodations for somebody, a lot of times we're going in and saying, look, you know, an individual may need lower lighting, or maybe they want, you know, need noise canceling headphones. Those are not accommodations that are going to break your bank. And in the same sense, like, you're going to also have somebody who's extremely dedicated to the work that they're doing, extremely loyal. They're not calling in sick. They're not, you know, sometimes you're having to force them to take their PTO because they just take so much ownership and pride in the work that they're doing. So we've been really fortunate. We've had a lot of really great partnerships with corporate organizations who are hiring our individuals, who want to know more about what that inclusive hiring looks like. They want to teach their employees how to work alongside of individuals with disabilities. So there's a lot going on there. And with the second building that I mentioned, we do have what's called a corporate engagement council, where we work specifically with businesses that have both bought into supporting the program through monetary gifts, as well as helping us build kind of that brain trust around the curriculum that we're offering and ensuring that we are targeting those skills that they really need to obtain a job in one of those industries.
Right. In other words, you're matching up the hipsters with the careers that fit them best. Am I saying that correctly?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what it's all about, right? So it's about finding the right fit for both sides. You know, just like, we're only successful when both sides are in alignment, right? So ensuring that the business understands what it's like to hire a hipster or somebody with a disability, making sure that what their needs are matched by the hipster we have skill set. So we do have a wonderful career services team that does that. They go out into the community, they look for those jobs, they match very intentionally hipsters to places that, number one, are within a reasonable distance of where they live and that they have transportation to get there. And again, just that the skill sets align and set them up for success.
I love the fact that, you know, My Possibilities, again, the name is so apropos. It's like, anything is possible. The goal is, you know, if you can conceive it, maybe you can achieve it, right?
Absolutely.
I want you to help pull back the curtain or dismiss some of the mysteries of intellectual developmental disabilities. In other words, some of the people who are hipsters, people who have never had hipsters in their lives, they may not know what they can and cannot do. Can you talk about what they can do versus what people perceive they cannot do?
Absolutely. And I love the way you framed that question. So a lot of times individuals with, you know, IDD or any other types of disabilities have spent a lot of times growing up with people focusing on the things they can't do. And so something that's extremely important for us while they're here is for us to focus on the things they can do, right? So it's more about their abilities versus their disabilities, and really trying to make them feel proud of the things they are able to do, and showing the community that they have these abilities, right? So we try and take that positive approach here. You know, we have some just incredible individuals here. I think we've talked before in the past about, we have some amazing artists that are here on campus who didn't even, like, no one really knew they had this incredible talent until they got into the program and were able to develop their own skills and specific techniques in their artwork. We have a hipster named Abby who's just incredible, and she's the perfect example of that and that creativity that's there. So, you know, I just mentioned the culinary arts track and how we have four hipsters already receive their food handlers permits. They They came around the building to show everyone that they got their certificates. They were so stoked. And what they shared with us was that the process for getting the permit required that you score 80% or higher on the evaluation. And all four of those hipsters scored over 90%.
Nice.
So I think that's another testament to, you know, there's so much there that they are capable of that people just don't realize. And a lot of times it's just thinking outside the box. You know, it's finding that accommodation. It's meeting them where they are, and not assuming that they can't do something just because of a label or a diagnosis.
I like the way you answer that question, breaking it down so well, because again, it's all about perceptions. And I also want to ask, because, you know, people don't know, or they're just like, say, wow, this is so interesting, when they're listening to the conversation for the first time. Again, we're talking with Adrienne Major. She's the director of marketing and communications with My Possibilities. And the thing I was going to ask you about was that, like I said, these perceptions, knowing what they can do or finding out what they can do at My Possibilities and being very encouraging. You mentioned one of the greatest assets that they have is they're extremely loyal and proud of the work that they do, unlike, you know, maybe someone that you find in a job placement category, or maybe someone who's just got out of high school or got out of college, but they have other things they want to do in life, and they're just like, okay, I'll do this for now. Can you talk about the advantages of not only their loyalty, but the fact that they're very, very proud of what they do?
Absolutely. I think when you are here on campus, it's, I know Kevin from KNC Masterpiece talks about this all the time.
You mean your husband, Kevin?
No, not my husband, Kevin. Kevin is the other one.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm kidding. Corey Major is your husband. I'm just messing with you.
He gets that all the time.
Yes.
You know, without getting any like copyright infringement here,
right.
He calls it the happiest place on earth.
It really is.
It's one of those things, you know, I'm on the development team, you know, we're out here talking about My Possibilities to people all the time. And there's just something that you can't quite articulate about that vibe and that buzz that you get when you're here on campus. And so we invite people constantly to come in and tour and see it for themselves in person. So to your question, you can feel it when you're walking around mm-hmm. downstairs. You feel how proud they are to be here, how much they enjoy having the opportunity to be with peers, to continue learning, to gain new skills, to work on things that, you know, people probably a lot in their lives told them they would never get to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's so much to be said about just that engagement and that opportunity, and how that just improves their lives from so many different standpoints. Hipster pride is a real thing. We have a
wait a minute. I like the way you put that. Hipster pride. Woo.
Hipster pride. And
yes,
they do.
Yeah.
They're slightly competitive, which is also really fun. We do things like North Texas Giving Day, and we break up into teams and fundraise for the organization. But the teams are kind of competing against each other to raise the most funds. And man, let me tell you, like hipster pride all day, that whole season of giving, you know, their teams are typically different colors. And so blue team tends to be the team that is the most vocal, and they will tell you like they're ecstatic. They want to raise money for their school. And I think that's what's amazing too, back to your point of like their abilities and things that they do that people don't necessarily think of. They're just as invested in making sure that this place is around forever and continues to serve more people. They are constantly coming up with creative ways to support the school. You know, North Texas Giving Day is a great example. We have what's called a hipster council. That's kind of like student council.
Mm-hmm.
They put on a cookout every year and raise money, from the food that they sell. And then that comes back to North Texas Giving Day to support the school. That group also was instrumental in, when we first moved into this building and we had specific chairs in the classrooms, they didn't have wheels on them and they were kind of heavy and difficult to move. And some of the hipsters said, you know, these chairs would be better if they had wheels on them. And their instructor said, well, yeah, but that's going to cost some money. And they said, well, we got this. So they came up with an idea of doing like a little relay, and they did a fundraiser and they raised the money and put the wheels on the chairs. So
I love that.
I think, you know, great examples of, you know, the ingenuity that's there and the creative minds that are there that, you know, without experiencing it firsthand, like you mentioned, you know, a lot of folks don't have experience with people in this population. And I think it's important to recognize that there are just so many things there outside of the disability that are wonderful, and honestly, an honor and a privilege to learn about our hipsters.
Adrienne, you just mentioned something. We got to go back to this because I want to hear about this. Okay. Your husband, Corey Majors, part of the KNC Masterpiece on 105.3 The Fan here at Odyssey on the middays.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. I don't know the details. So you have to break this down. I understand that the Hipsters with My Possibilities took on Jared Sandler, who is the pre- and post-game Ranger broadcaster, 105.3 The Fan, Texas Rangers World Series champion, took on his nonprofit, The Sandlot, that crew. Mm-hmm. And what was the competition? Because I know it was very competitive.
Brutal.
Please so break this down.
I'm so glad you asked that. So that was kind of, I was going to lean there.
First of all, who said let's go against each other? Whose idea was it to come up with a competition? Because I know the Hipsters are competitive.
So last year, about a year and a half ago, we launched what's called the North Texas Unified Soccer League. And it is a league made up of our Hipsters and community partners. And then some are just other individuals in the community that have IDD as well. And we put them on unified teams. So we just ended this spring season or summer season, and Jared's team, the Sandlot, and the Sidekicks were the two teams competing, battling it out for first place. So Corey was playing on the Sidekicks, and my son Carter, our middle son, was also playing with them, mm-hmm. and Sandlot. And it was brutal. They were so competitive. At one point, I think Jamie, who oversees the league, was like, we're going to have to call this game if you guys can't get it together. We have some incredible athletes. A lot of our individuals are involved in Special Olympics, so they've mm-hmm. been playing soccer forever. We have some of our community partners that played for the FC Dallas Unified team.
Oh, they didn't know.
Really incredible. I think maybe Jared sent some ringers for his team that day, but mm-hmm. I don't have proof. So it was a very close fight, and I think the final score was 11-9, and Sandlot won. So,
oh boy, that means it's going to be a rematch.
On Sidekicks, we're very upset.
There will be a rematch. I can tell this thing's going to be a yearly competition. I can just tell. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Can you also talk about, you were talking about how competitive they can be, and the Hipsters are very, very competitive and extremely loyal and outstanding employees. Can you talk about what age, if you have a Hipster in your life, in your family, mm-hmm. that they could start working or attending classes at My Possibilities? What are the age ranges, and, you know, high to low?
Great question. So generally, we are supporting individuals that are 18 and older. Mm-hmm. There is no age out of the program. Our oldest Hipster, I believe, is 71.
Look out.
So generally, we're seeing individuals when they come out of school. So if you aren't familiar, here in the state of Texas, if you are part of the special education department within public schools, they do tend to have an adult transition program for ages 18 to 22. So you can stay in public school until you're 22 if you're part of that special education program. So sometimes we're getting individuals that are coming right after that. So mm-hmm. kind of in that 22 age range. This year was the first time we opened up a summer camp. I think we only have a few weeks left of that camp for ages 14 to 22. And that is more geared, again, it's that early vocation mm-hmm. type of skills. And so that's been really great to be able to see kind of a younger group come in. One thing to note that's really exciting is that because we opened the Employment Innovation School last year, we now have more space. And if you aren't familiar, the need is very great here in the area. We have over 206,000 individuals who have disabilities in North Texas alone. So we've always had a pretty lengthy wait list, and it's super exciting. We have a unique opportunity right now where we actually have immediate availability in all of our programs.
Oh, great.
So if you do know someone in your family that is getting close to that 18-year-old mark, or they're older, please come check out our website. Go reach out to our admissions team. We're constantly bringing in folks for tours, and we would love to just be able to continue to serve more individuals in the area.
How long has My Possibilities been around? Refresh everybody.
We just celebrated our sweet 16, so hey. 16 years. Yeah.
That's fantastic. And it has grown and grown and grown over the years. Was there ever a point where you thought, like, oh boy, we're not going to be able to make it? Was it during the pandemic or was it before then? Because, you know, I always say every organization go through highs and lows. They go through sure. periods where you're like, oh, we won't be able to do it. And then something happens and it's like, wow, they're vaulted into another level.
I would say no. I don't think that's ever been an option.
Oh, good.
You know, we have to continue to do this. And mm-hmm. so I don't think anyone's ever said, I don't think this is going to be able to continue forward. Now, obviously, during COVID, that was a very trying time for us. Our doors were closed for about 12 weeks, and there's a whole lot that factors into that. You know, we have individuals mm-hmm. that are here that receive Medicaid waiver funding. We weren't receiving any funding from the state at all during those 12 weeks that we were closed. So
you didn't get a stimulus check? Oh, my goodness.
We were very fortunate that we applied for the PPP loans. And so we were able to keep our staff intact,
nice.
Which was really great. Continue to pay them. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I don't know what we would have been able to do without that. So mm-hmm. that was hugely impactful. But we just knew that closing wasn't an option. You know,
right.
there are too many people that need these services. We see the benefits that they get out of being engaged and socializing. So, then in our community, right? Like how wonderful it is for our community to be able to interact and accept and embrace all these folks that truly deserve it. You know, they deserve everything that anyone deserves, right? They want to live their
exactly fullest their
life.
Best
so,
life. And all
absolutely
and anything's possible, which is why my possibilities exist. And again, you open the new campus, which of course is the only campus for individuals with cognitive disabilities, adults in the state of Texas. I mean, it's the first ever college campus for this. And I'm sure have you been getting hipster applications from around the country at all? Is this just North Texas? I know it's for North Texas, but you know, since it's so unique.
That's a great question. So generally speaking, we have about 9 different counties that we serve. Mm-hmm. So we are mostly the North Texas area. However, we do offer online programming for those that fits their abilities and their
okay.
needs. And so we do have a few that are outside of Texas. I think we have one that's from New York, and we had one that's still in Texas, but like in San Antonio. So we were able to reach further than just our little DFW bubble, which is amazing. You know, the like I said, the need is huge, even beyond just North Texas. So the fact that we're able to reach so many people, even here locally, is really incredible.
Can you talk about some of the partners? Because again, you can't do this alone. And fortunately,
absolutely.
You've had partners, not only time and talent, but they've also mm-hmm. given some treasure.
Correct. So, we are so grateful and appreciative of the community support that we receive. We serve nearly 600 individuals, both through like our programming on campus and out in the community and supported employment environments. And with that, you know, we've got a lot of family members that are incredibly supportive, but we do rely on fundraising. You know, mm-hmm. we need that to help us ensure that we can continue to provide the top quality services that our families are used to receiving and being able to serve more individuals. So corporate partners are always a great source of support, whether they're sponsoring one of our events or they've joined our corporate engagement council that I mentioned earlier. You know, we do fundraising events throughout the year. We had a big gala back in May that raised about $670,000.
Excellent.
Gross total. So, and then we do North Texas Giving Day, which is so much fun on September 19th, which is an online fundraising day. So that's a wonderful way for people just to be able to kind of peek in behind the curtains a little bit to see what's going on here on campus. We do a lot of stuff on Facebook Live and share videos out with the community to see what we're doing. We make the day fun. It's competitive, like I mentioned, raising funds. Last year, we raised just under $300,000 on the day.
Wow.
So we'll be, you know, trying to get to new higher heights this year, if you will.
Yeah, get some goals.
Here we try. Mm-hmm, we have some goals. We do that. And then, you know, we have a golf tournament every year. So it's always great to have new golfers come out and learn about what we're doing and support us that way. So, you know, community support is just so important to what we do and ensuring that we're able to continue helping our hipsters thrive.
Let's talk about that gala for a minute. I was fortunate enough, you guys asked me to MC one of the galas a couple of years ago. And
it was so great.
I got to tell you about something that just, I had the biggest grin on my face because I'm going to describe this as a movie moment. Follow me on this, okay? Follow me on this. It's like a movie moment. Okay, I always said for years and years and years, movie watching is a sport. So I loved going to the movies. And I was mm-hmm. reading this article, and it was one of these articles about how Hollywood makes movies and things. And it was a really good article. And it was talking about when they have like a comedy or a romantic comedy, or they have some fun movie. At the end of the movie, they just do this. They found out that it worked, that people just love this. No matter how the movie ended, at the very end, the cast starts dancing. And I was like, what? Now, I read this in the late 1990s. I was like, what? And I started paying attention that at the end of the movies, even if the movie was just an average movie, everybody's dancing at the end of the movie. If the movie is great and everybody's like, oh, this is one of the best movies, everybody is at the end of this movie, they're dancing. Even animated movies, they're dancing at the end of these movies. And I just started paying attention to it, and they were saying this because it makes the people who go to the movie feel good. Mm-hmm. So let me circle back to the gala. I swear, at the end of the gala, you go to any benefits, usually there's a dance or something afterwards. They stick around, they got a band playing, but you guys have the hipsters go out to dance. The hipsters love to dance, and I swear, it was like watching a movie at the end of the movie. I was so happy. I was like, look at them. Yeah, it was greatness.
Really the best part of the night. And honestly, you know, they hold us to this. We try to keep our program of the night very short because they just want to get out on the dance floor and have fun. And
exactly.
Right?
So, yeah, that's what I forgot to throw in that part. Hurry up. Hurry up. Don't make this go long because the hipsters want
to
dance.
We tight to our time frame to ensure that they can get out there on the dance floor because they don't want to sit and hear everyone talking. They just want to dance and have fun. So it is, you know, our gala is very unique in that it not only is it a fundraiser, it's also a night to celebrate our hipsters and to give them a special night to get dressed up and dance and hang out with their friends. So it's kind of like a prom for them as well. So we do try and hurry up and get to the good stuff. And we have a live band. The band has been amazing the past few years. They come out on the dance floor with the hipsters. Fun fact is that the dance floor that we build, I think, is bigger than most events ever have for a dance floor. So that's part of the why, you know, when we look for space for our gala, not only does it need to accommodate the number of people that we're having, we need to make sure it also can accommodate the size of the dance floor that we need for our hipsters.
I'm telling you, Adrian, it'll be a big hit if you guys make a TikTok of the hipsters dancing. I'm telling you, it would blow everybody's minds. They'd be so happy. It's just so great.
We've had a TikTok go viral not too long ago.
Look out.
Why? Too. Yeah. So
tell me about it.
You should definitely check it out. During the holidays, speaking of community partners from earlier, we have our glee club and choir practice for the semester. Mm-hmm. And then we have different businesses that will reach out and say, hey, we'd love to have them come sing at our office. So we do a little traveling show during the holidays and take them out to sing for different businesses. And it's just so fun. And they were practicing one day and Blair, our marketing and communications officer, went down to get the content that she always does because it is a very content rich place here. And she recorded a video of them practicing some of the holiday songs, and it went like uber viral on
TikTok. Wow. So that's awesome. Fun. That is just so awesome. Is there anything you think people need to know that we did not bring up?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I could do this all day.
I want everybody to know all the greatness of my possibilities. So let your brain just roll while I say this again. We've talked about partners. We've talked about the new campus. We've talked about the age range for the hipsters that attend the classes and the job placement programs. And I think we even, is there a hipster story individual? I mean, I know you got a million of them where there's been a hipster that's either just excited everybody or exceeded all expectations, or you just knew this young lady or this guy was going to do something fantastic and it happened.
Well, that's a good one. You know, one that actually comes to mind very quickly is a hipster named James, who was playing soccer for the North Texas Unified Soccer League. He has played soccer all growing up and is a very, very, very talented player. And you can even ask Corey about this offline and he'll share what that experience was like working alongside him as he joined their team during soccer. And we found out fairly recently that he's moving and we were very sad because they're leaving Texas. However, he's getting to go and coach soccer for youth with disabilities. And I just think that's such a neat thing that you know, this opportunity came about for him. You know, he won't have My Possibilities where he's going, but he's going to have that opportunity, which I think just speaks volumes to, again, the abilities and the skill that's out there that the people maybe just don't recognize. So we're all very excited for James. Sad that he won't be here on campus with us anymore, but super stoked that he has that opportunity.
Yeah, that's fantastic, especially for him. And I'm sure he's going to come back and visit. And speaking of visiting, are there opportunities, if someone has a hipster in their life, to like take a tour of the campus in case they might want to enroll one day?
Absolutely. So if you go to our website, it's mypossibilities.org. There's a tab for admissions. And
getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you, and also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at tmobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Left 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
We used to require that you tour ahead of time. Now there are... it's a lot easier. We're trying to lessen the barriers, right? Mm-hmm. Because we know that it's so great and we don't currently have a wait list. So yeah, absolutely. If you go check that out, admissions@nptx.org is the email, I believe. And you just shoot them a note and they will schedule a time. They have folks coming in all the time to check the place out. You know, we're open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. And we'd love to have people come up, and we are super thrilled to be able to say that we have immediate openings for people with a hipster in their life. So definitely reach out.
Fantastic. She is Adria Major. She's the Director of Marketing and Communications at My Possibilities. Please, Adrian, we got to get you back on again soon.
I would love it. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
From Odyssey, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, this is I'm Listening, Talk Away the Dark, a limited series. Today, Dr. Maria Boynton from our Atlanta, Georgia properties hosts an intimate conversation on mental health and suicide prevention in Black, Brown, and all communities of color during Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. Maria is joined by American Foundation for Suicide Prevention expert Victor Armstrong and Sarah Dixon Hackey, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Liaison for Clay County Public Health. Now, here's Dr. Maria Boynton.
Vic and Sarah, welcome. So Vic, with it being Minority Mental Health Month, when we talk about the African-American church, mental health from your purview, how is it received? How is it addressed?
I think it's changing some now. We're starting to see some progress, but there's still a long way to go. I grew up in a community where both my Black community and my faith-based community really kind of ingrained in me that suicide and mental health challenges were not things that impacted my community. And that if they did impact my community as a person of faith, my remedy should be more faith, that I should be able to pray about it, that I should be able to talk to God about it. But there was never a conversation about talk with mental health professionals. I think one of the things that I've come to learn later, though, now that I am in this space, is that while there was a narrative within my community that was reinforced by my community about mental health and suicide not being things that impacted us, there was also a reinforcement of that message coming from outside the community by the simple fact that the organizations that specialized in this field, the organizations that specialized in suicide prevention, the organizations that specialized in mental health, we're not reaching into my community saying, no, this is about you. We want to provide resources that are relevant to your community. And so what that tended to do was that it reinforced that my message must be correct. My narrative must be correct. And my narrative was a narrative that really was based on misinformation or lack of information. And so part of what I've learned since then, too, is that if we want to break a lot of that stigma, institutions like faith-based organizations in Black and Brown communities can be very instrumental in doing that. And I think really have a responsibility because of the relationship to the community to help us to really fix a lot of those challenges, those historical challenges that our communities have faced.
And Sarah, in your community, can you share with us what the perceptions are and how mental health is addressed in your community? What's been your experience?
You know, it kind of, I think there's a couple different experiences I would look at. One from, I think, from my time growing up, certainly, which was in a small town in the Midwest. It was really, I think, this, I think, perspective or overall experience of having kind of a, well, for, in a lot of ways, a racial minority kind of perspective, because I lived and was raised by a white family. And so a lot of their values or all their values were really passed on to me. And much of that was based around the church. And I think just our community in general is a small town. But I think because of that, we really live by this principle of not really talking about our issues, not really addressing or acknowledging those deeper emotional, I think, kind of themes. And that really translated into how I saw mental health, even with my own personal struggles. And I think because of that, it really shaped how I address things until much later in life. So I think for me personally, you know, a lot of my values came from this idea of keeping everything, you know, to kind of actually pull from an AFSB concept, which is keeping things in the dark, very much, you know, keeping it to yourself and knowing that we don't deal with those things in public. Those are private behind the closed doors, and you certainly don't talk about them with anyone else.
Sarah, being Asian, as I'm looking at you now, being a member of the Asian community, and you say that you were raised by a white couple, have you been able to see a differential between how the Asian community views mental health issues versus that of the Caucasian community? Is there a difference? And how, if so, how have you been able to bridge that gap?
That's a really complicated question and a good one, to be honest with you. You know, to be honest, I didn't for a long time, and I still am struggling with that, finding, I think, a sense of what the Asian community's perspective is, because I was so isolated in my own experience. I can literally count on one hand the number of minorities, I think, that I was raised around in my young time. And so, you know, I truly believe that it wasn't until I hit my 30s that I saw this acknowledgement of even wanting to look outside of the majority, because I spent so much time really wanting to be part of the larger majority, wanting to be part of and fall into that group. So I didn't pay attention for a long time. But I think that when I look now through the work that I do with public health, some of the members of the Asian community, I know certainly, you know, and it really depends on what part of, you know, Asia you're really talking about, but there are parts of the world, quite frankly, that I would say are, you know, a few decades behind in terms of our openness, right? We look at the U.S. as making a lot of progress, as we have, in this openness of conversation and using the phrases mental health. And I think we have to be mindful of the fact that other communities, including those that are Asian, are not at that same point.
We know the research, we know the statistics that mental health can be especially stigmatized among minority communities. Vic, in your experience, how has that changed? And is it getting better? I guess my question should be.
I think it is getting better, partly because we are seeing more of a willingness for high-profile individuals to talk about their mental health challenges. We're seeing more celebrities, more athletes. We're also, I think, being more thoughtful about how we reach different communities. For example, we have a partnership at AFSP with Megan Thee Stallion, because we know that she reaches young people. And so it's really thinking about those kinds of things and how we reach the communities that way. I think the other thing, too, is that we're also thinking differently about who are the influencers in communities, who already has that trusted relationship with the community. And we're doing a better job of coming alongside those organizations, institutions, faith-based community being one of those. One of the programs we have at AFSP is Soul Shop for Black Churches. It's teaching faith leaders in the Black community how to talk about suicide with their congregants. And so that helps to eliminate a lot of the stigma, because a lot of the stigma has been perpetrated by the faith-based community. A lot of the stigma has been perpetrated by this notion that athletes are supposed to be stoic and strong and not show vulnerability, that men in general are not supposed to show vulnerability. And so I think the more that we can demonstrate that there's strength in vulnerability, we start to see that stigma come down some. Now, the flip side of that, though, is while we are seeing the stigma come down, we are seeing an uptick in the rate of suicide in Black and brown communities. So we still have to be very proactive in thinking about and thinking differently about how we reach communities to address the stigma that still does exist on many levels.
Sarah, what have you found among those struggling with suicidal thoughts or behaviors? What have you found to be the biggest factor? Is it being ashamed to ask for help, or what have you found?
I think always kind of a complex question. I always kind of defer to the fact that certainly suicide is extremely complex. There's a lot of factors of what prevent people from speaking out. But certainly I think stigma is a common thread that I see again and again. I think the last time we had kind of chatted one other time, so, and I think Vic said this so well, that a lot of times we don't have the vocabulary. And I think about it in the sense that, you know, you look at a young person, and I mean, really young, and you think about kids who point to something and they call it the wrong thing, right? You know, I have nieces and nephews, and I remember when they were kind of growing up and they would point at something and call it something different, but you knew what they were talking about, but they just couldn't express themselves. And that frustration eventually would kind of defer into them not really talking about that or just going on to something else. And I think sometimes that lack of ability to have that vocabulary, and then the audience that's willing to sit with them. Because I think, again, one of the things that I see a lot of times when I do my mental health first aid trainings is that we are well-versed in being participants in conversations and sometimes dominating those discussions. But we're not well-versed in being observers and sounding boards. And I think that oftentimes, especially now, is something where we lack that education and that practice. And so I think knowing that, you know, maybe that person that you're with, you're afraid they're going to judge you, that they aren't going to receive what you have to say, or they're going to try and fix it for you, right? Any of those three things oftentimes prevents us from speaking out.
You know, and I would add to that too, Maria, because I think Sarah unpacked a lot of really important points there. And when we think about kids, I think one of the challenges that we have, and one of the things that we can do differently, is that we start out early on teaching kids how to identify basic emotions. We teach them how to identify when you're happy, when you're sad, when you're angry. We don't teach them how to identify when you're lonely, how to identify when you're vulnerable, how to identify those things that can, if left unchecked, can lead to mental health challenges. And I think that's part of what we have to recognize, because as Sarah pointed out, suicide, it really is a complex issue. And I point out to people all the time that suicide itself is not a disease. It is the worst possible outcome of a lot of very complex things, often including mental health challenges. And if that's the case, that means that there are ways that we can reach people before they get to that point of suicidality if we have the resources in place to address people at their point of need in the communities where people live, work, play, and pray. And I think that's part of our challenge, is recognizing those things that can lead a person to suicidality and being able to address those things more effectively before they reach that point.
Vic, of course, we talk about the stigma, but then we, in our previous conversations, we talked about how some families are able to deal with the mental illness, not necessarily from the critical standpoint, but more so from the accepting standpoint. And the community understands that that family might have some issues, or someone in their home who has mental health issues, not necessarily every single day, but there might be outbursts, things of that nature. How have you found the community to be in terms of those situations where families don't necessarily have the extreme outward signs of mental health, but more of a subdued presentation? What have you found?
I think that's an interesting point, because part of what I've seen is that communities and families have a willingness to take care of their own. And I think in part, some of the way that we have socialized the approach to mental health and mental health challenges, not just in America, but I think globally, really has done some damage, because I think a lot of the stigma that's attached to mental health challenges has come from the way that we talk about it and the way that we address it outside of communities. I think a lot of what has happened over time, as I think back to my childhood growing up, I can identify people that I know, even family members of mine that had mental health challenges. But there were people that took care of them. They did not live in hospitals. They did not live in institutions. They lived at home with family members surrounded by people who loved them and cared about them. Now, was it the most clinically therapeutic environment? Probably not. But they had social connection. And I think that's one of the pieces that communities and families naturally provide that oftentimes we miss. And so I think part of what we have to think about is how do we look at those things that are that families and communities are doing at the community level that are working to keep people living in the community? And how do we create more of those things? What often happens is that we provide resources that really are about how we can draw down our funds, about how we can further our brand. And it's not always focused on the specific needs of communities. If we want to know how to better serve communities and how to allow communities to better serve themselves and serve family members, all we have to do is ask them. And so I think that's part of what we have to think differently about going forward as systems is how do we tap into communities, look at things that are working at the community level, look at how communities are already taking care of their own, and then how do we join and come alongside those things as opposed to creating something in a laboratory and then trying to force it on communities, because there are some lessons to be learned in how communities take care of each other.
My thanks to Vic Armstrong from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and Sarah Dixon Hackey, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Liaison for Clay County Public Health for joining me today for this vital conversation. For more information on how you can start the conversation in your community, please visit afsp.org. And if at any time you or someone you know is in crisis and needs to talk with someone right away, please call or text 988. I'm Dr. Maria Boynton, and this is I'm Listening.
To find out more about Talk Away the Dark, please visit afsp.org. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988. For the full show and more stories like this one, download the I'm Listening podcast on the Odyssey app or visit imlistening.org. From Odyssey, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, this is I'm Listening, Talk Away the Dark, a limited series. Today, Dr. Maria Boynton from our Atlanta, Georgia properties hosts an intimate conversation on mental health and suicide prevention in Black, Brown, and all communities of color during Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. Maria is joined by American Foundation for Suicide Prevention expert Victor Armstrong and Sarah Dixon Hackey, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Liaison for Clay County Public Health. Now, here's Dr. Maria Boynton.
Vic and Sarah, welcome. Sarah, in your personal experiences, in your family, I mean, what have you found to be the situation when it comes to mental health and how it's approached from the family standpoint and the community?
We really looked at meeting with community leaders, which is different than I think what we sometimes idealize in American culture. And I always try to impress that, which is, you know, every leader is in their own right, sometimes a self-proclaimed leader, and it can look different, right? It's not like a president or a councilman. It's someone who holds respect. And so a lot of times they're referred to as elders in their communities. And so when we look at that, it's how do we bring these people who have purpose and to hold a lot of, I think, influence and respect along in these discussions, and then give them the tools, allow them to choose the tools that they find or use best in their communities, not just to help their individuals that maybe need it, but also themselves. Because I think the piece that I find sometimes happens is in these communities where they really are taking care of one another is the lack of respite care for themselves, right? Because we need to remember that the caretaker also is taking on just as much stress, if not more, as they're trying to work through that. So we want to support and strengthen those families so that there isn't that overtaxing on one side, other ways. And also, how do we use the language? I mean, this is something I kind of fight a personal battle with in my own department again and again, which is we can't just bring in any translator. We can't just, you know, go to Google Translate and say, hey, let's just throw it out there and hope that it works. My favorite example is really this idea that, you know, there's concepts that we have in Western medicine that literally do not translate over into other languages. And I remember this one in the Midwest where, you know, it's essentially in one of the language, I think it was Bhutanese, where if you were asking a patient, if, you know, here we're explaining that you're going to have chemo treatment, that it translates into we're going to put fire into your body. And so if you think about it in that phrase, we're not really doing apples to apples. And so we have to think more, I think, individualistically and not, I think, which a lot of times we try to think efficiently, which I think Vic kind of alluded to, right? We have to slow down. And that's just maybe not within our structure right now, but we have to do that.
I love that concept too about thinking differently about leaders, because I think one of the things that we always try to do we engage communities is we try to find those trusted messengers in the community so that they can take the message to the folks in the community who already have relationship with them. But I think one of our challenges is that we don't often know how to recognize those leaders in communities. I use my situation as an example. Growing up in a rural community, my father always had a full-time job. He was a kind of in disaster restoration by trade. So he cleaned up after fire and water damage. And he had a business that he did that. But he was also a bishop in the Church of Christ in my community. And oftentimes we don't realize, and I talk to organizations about this, oftentimes we're looking at trusted leaders in communities. The person who may be the custodian at your organization could be a local pastor who has influence in the community. But we often don't think about what leadership looks like from the community's lens. We look at leadership through our lens. We do the same thing, but we talk about collaboration. We talk about partnership. We have a lens for what collaboration and partnership looks like, but we don't stop to think about what is collaboration, what does partnership look like from the community's lens. Because, and we'd be a whole lot more effective in addressing the challenges that communities face if we were able to engage communities through their lens on their terms.
Collaboration, partnership, Sarah, you talked about strengthening the family. What other tools do you feel we need when it comes to helping to prevent suicide among the mental health community?
You know, I think Vic actually touched on this a little bit before, but I think, you know, one of the biggest crises that's really been identified already by the Surgeon General is this idea of isolation. I was struck by the fact, I was just reviewing some reports for our state, and it was actually quite disheartening to see that. So in our college kind of system in North Dakota, we have different campuses, and the average percent of individuals who took basically this health assessment at these universities for whether or not they identified as lonely or what they could, you know, kind of be perceived as lonely, there was about 40 to 45% of the campuses across the board that had a rate of that basically the students rated as lonely or, you know, suffering from loneliness, which I find just very interesting considering, you know, when I look at my time in college, I absolutely did not consider myself lonely. I was probably a little too social for my own good. And so, you know, I look at these young people and it really concerns me because this is the time when ideally you are the most surrounded by your peers, right? So what are we going to do to prepare them as they move into a different phase and they're really finding challenges, as we know, as adults that can be even more isolating? So I think, you know, the question here is, you know, we look at tools, how do we support people in connecting? And I think it looks a lot of different ways. I do think, you know, there's conversations happening at the national level with AFSP about what that looks like and other health institutes too. But I think it's, how do we bring back this ability to actually connect with one another? Is because just being around each other, that's not freedom from isolation. You know, there's something deeper that has to happen. And so, you know, part of that is relearning or reintroducing that to, I think, our communities. And I know even with our international immigrants, you know, we've seen that. I've seen grants that have been coming through on both the state and national level that have really focused on this idea, how do we bring people together? And I think, you know, for myself, especially being in the Midwest, it's hard, right? Because we have about, it feels like 9 months out of the year instead of three, but several months out of the year, getting outside of the house is really a challenge. So, you know, I think all those factors come into play when it comes to you finding tools And I think that also falls on us as a community and cities to do a better job there.
What about those who have attempted suicide? I was at an event once and a young lady approached me and said she'd attempted suicide, I think, 4 or 5 times, and she was still struggling. How do we approach that particular area? Sarah, in your sessions, does that come up from those who may have attempted suicide, were not, you know, in their mind successful? I mean, what's the struggle there?
As the individual, as the outsider, if you will, or the person who's being the supporting institution, again, I think we have to remember that, and I think this is something that sometimes people don't realize, that for individuals who are struggling, you know, about the first time that they really have that first struggle or the development of a challenge of mental health or substance use, on average in the U.S., it can be about 10 years before people actually seek professional assistance or intervention. And so I say that not to be negative or to dash anyone's hopes, but to look at it as this is really a marathon, right? This isn't a one stop, we're going to fix this, boom, it's done. And I think that's sometimes the perception. I myself have lived with clinical generalized anxiety for most of my life. I think my first bout of it was probably when I was about 5 years old, to be quite frank. And you know, when I married my husband, we had to have some long conversations about him understanding that, oh, you going to the therapist once isn't going to fix this issue, or you taking this anti-anxiety med doesn't mean it's going to be gone in 3 months, like an antibiotic. Because I think it's really about health maintenance and this ongoing cycle of taking care of yourself. So I think that's a lot of times, too, is demystifying and, you know, kind of also breaking some of those myths that people have about mental health care.
When it comes to your health maintenance, Sarah, I mean, would you care to share your routine at all?
Oh, gosh, that is a juggling act. And I think that's really, honestly, I don't know. And, you know, I definitely want to hear Vic, because I know you're going to say something too. But like, I think it really changes. And I think that's the hardest part and the best part, right? Because you're always figuring out what works next. But for me, it's really a balance. And I think what I love about the AFSP is that it really tapped into this idea of feeding my understanding that this is something I have some element of control over, right? Because when you're dealing with mental health, you feel like you have zero control sometimes. So knowing that I have things like exercise and diet and even like sleep or getting out, I think all of those things together, and I think it's really important to know that nothing is a one fix element. They all kind of work congruently. And so I think for me, it's always finding that balance between them.
To the point about mental wellness, you know, one of the things that I often use as a hashtag and when I post to social media is weightlifting is my therapy. That for me is one of the things that helps me maintain my mental well-being. And it's for me, it's not about vanity, although, you know, there are benefits to physical exercise. But there are things about lifting weights, which is what I do every day. It causes me to regulate my breathing. It causes me to be mindful of what my body is doing. It causes me to push myself when I get uncomfortable. I have a routine that I get up very early in the morning. And so it causes me to have that structure, that discipline. And my wife is the first to say, if I miss a day or two without going to the gym, she'll tell me, you need to go work out. Because she can see a difference, because it is what really kind of helps me to regulate my mental well-being in a lot of ways. But to Sarah's point, do what works for you. There is no one approach. There are some givens, like fresh air and sunshine does a body good. Getting exercise on some level. It may not be lifting weights. It may be taking a walk, getting outside, taking a walk, if you're able to do those kinds of things. But find whatever works for you. You know, taking mindfulness breaks during the day, just taking time to unplug, getting off social media, because social media can be a steady stream of either negativity or sensationalism. My 10-year-old now come to me just about every day with some wild thing he saw on the internet that he tells me as truth. you know, I saw on the internet that there's this animal that does, and I'm like, no, that's not real. But I saw it on the internet. No, it's not real. But there are people that struggle with, you know, trying to digest things that they're seeing on the internet. And so, you know, so I tell people all the time, unplug. But you know, again, to Sarah's point, there is no one size fits all. But find what works for you to help you maintain that mental balance.
No one size fits all. We all agree there is much work to be done, but it doesn't have to be viewed as being a daunting task, right, Sarah?
Not at all. I mean, so I always tell people, keep your eyes open. There's more resources than I think we realize.
Keeping your eyes open, and too, Vic, knowing that so many just want to be heard, we have to consider that as well, right?
Absolutely. And I think we also have to consider that oftentimes people who are living with challenges, people who are struggling either mentally or emotionally, sometimes reach out for help in ways that we don't always realize. And so it is about people do want to be heard, but oftentimes we need to look differently at how we hear people. We need to get better at recognizing the signs and symptoms that someone is struggling. And then we need to give people the space that when we recognize they do want to talk, they want to open up, we have to give them the space to do that and to give them the space to do that in a way that's comfortable for them.
My thanks to Vic Armstrong from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and Sarah Dixon Hackey, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Liaison for Clay County Public Health, for joining me today for this vital conversation. For more information on how you can start the conversation in your community, please visit afsp.org. And if at any time you or someone you know is in crisis and needs to talk with someone right away, please call or text 988. I'm Dr. Maria Boynton, and this is I'm Listening.
To find out more about Talk Away the Dark, please visit afsp.org. And if you or someone you know is in crisis, please call or text 988. For the full show and more stories like this one, download the I'm Listening podcast on the Odyssey app or visit imlistening.org.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get four 5G phones on us and four lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.